Hello and welcome to episode 15 of the Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life podcast. My name is Plantagenetly Marcus Freestone. Firstly, apologies for the maybe slightly odd sounding sound effects or quality of my voice. I've had a bit of flu, so I'm a bit croaky, but I wanted to get this episode out anyway. So, at the moment, I'm sucking a locket. Black currant. Anyway, this episode is about the work of P.D. Ouspensky. I did mention Gurdjieff and Ouspensky in the previous episode, and so I'll be talking about them, but I think a more thorough introduction is needed here, and then we're going to have some readings from Ouspensky's book, The Fourth Way. The first thing to say is that the book that I'm reading from, The Fourth Way, although it was published in the 50s, it actually dates from a few decades previously to that. The whole book is, as was common to Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, they didn't actually write that much themselves. They tended to deliver lectures, and people basically took down verbatim these lectures, and they were published later on, in this case after Ouspensky's death. So the words that you're going to hear me reading today are, well, they date back to the 1920s and 30s. And Ouspensky died in 47. So they date back to a sort of pre-World War II period. So the masculine pronoun is the only one that's used. Some of the other language sounds kind of outdated or odd, but I don't believe in historical revisionism and, you know, going back and changing things. That's the way the world was then, you know, get over it. Sorry, that sounded a bit more aggressive than I meant it to, but I have had a sore throat and a runny nose for the last week. Not that that's an excuse for being aggressive to my podcast listeners. Maybe you didn't think it sounded aggressive. Maybe it's just that my ears are a bit blocked, so I'm suddenly a bit more aggressive. Anyway, let's get on with the podcast, not, you know, talk about my flu. G.I. Gurdjieff, I know that kind of, as I say it now, it sounds like he was in the army. No, George Ivanovich Gurdjieff was a Russian stroke Greek stroke Armenian philosopher, mystic, physician. His origins and exact date of birth aren't that known, but he was born roughly in sort of 1870s and died in the 1949. He was a qualified physician, I think, with some practicing experience, such as medical training was in those days, and just enjoying this locket. He developed this quite complicated system he called the work, which was to overcome what he saw as humanity's sort of psychological and social problems. It sounds a bit like he was a cult leader. It wasn't. He did have a place in France in the 20s and 30s, I think, that was called the Foundation for the Harmonious Development of Man. I'm not in any way, I'm a big fan of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky's writings. I obviously never met them or saw them taught because they died long before I was born. I'm not in any way a disciple of theirs. If I thought it was a cult, I would say so. Some of what they wrote and talked about was absolute nonsense. There's stuff really kind of esoteric, weird occult stuff about the rays of creation and some bizarre sort of stuff about the universe. But then, back when they were writing, scientists thought the Milky Way was the whole universe. So, you know, you can't really blame them for that. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a cult. But yeah, some of what they said was nonsense, but a lot of it was really good, sound, practical stuff, the sort that we like here on this podcast, he said, giving himself the royal we. I mean, me and the listeners. Which also sounds arrogant. Anyway, sorry, get back to the topic. So, yeah, so Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, yeah, some of what they wrote was nonsense, but a lot of it is very kind of practical, down-to-earth stuff with very strong parallels with modern psychology. In fact, some of it is, it could have been taken from a psychology textbook, and a lot of it is very existential. It's very kind of down-to-earth and talking about the practicalities of basically of negative thinking and negative emotions. That's a lot. A huge amount of Gurdjieff's work was the system he called the work was trying to get people to overcome negative thinking and negative emotions, which is obviously what we're concerned with on this podcast. And the other parts of it were to do with he thought that we were existing in such a low level of consciousness that we might as well be asleep. One of Gurdjieff's few books is called The War Against Sleep. No, it isn't. That's a book by Colin Wilson about Gurdjieff, I think. But yeah, Gurdjieff and Ouspensky's thing, apart from the whole overcoming negative and counterproductive thinking and emotions, was that we're on such a low level of consciousness, our consciousness is so dim compared to what it could be, that we might as well be asleep. And Gurdjieff's whole thing was trying to shock us into waking up. I think next week I'll look in more detail at Gurdjieff and the work that he did, which includes some quite interesting, basically, psychological experiments that he carried out for years on the people at his institute, but also on himself. So he wasn't a cult leader. He didn't get anyone to do anything he wasn't prepared to do himself. And in fact, he pushed himself so hard physically in trying to gain control over his own consciousness that it ultimately damaged his health. So that's a rather rambling background. Don't worry, I'll edit that down. Okay, we'll crack on now with a few minutes reading from Ouspensky's The Fourth Way. I say this is all question and answers from lectures, and he lectured all over the world. I believe Ouspensky was a Russian journalist, but I believe he spent the last 20 years of his life living in England. I'm not entirely sure why. But he died in England in 1947. And I think there was, and maybe still is, a Gurdjieff Institute in London. But I know that he lectured a lot here. I'm not sure where these lectures are taken from. But anyway, this is getting into very much the psychological part of the work of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky. So here are some questions and answers from an Ouspensky lecture. Question: is the control of your emotions a reasonable objective? Answer: control of emotions is a very difficult thing. It is a very important part of self-study, but we cannot begin with the control of emotions because we do not understand enough about emotions. I will explain. What we can do from the very beginning of observing the emotional function is to try to stop one particular manifestation in ourselves. We must try to stop the manifestation of unpleasant emotions. For many people, this is one of the most difficult things, because unpleasant emotions are expressed so quickly and so easily that you cannot catch them. Yet unless you try, you cannot really observe yourself. So from the very beginning, when observing emotions, you must try to stop the expression of unpleasant emotions. This is the first step. In this system, we call all these unpleasant, violent, or depressing emotions by the name negative emotions. As I said, the first step is trying not to express these negative emotions. The second step is the study of negative emotions themselves, making lists of them, finding their connections, because some of them are simple and some are compound, and trying to understand that they are quite useless. It sounds strange, but it is very important to understand that all negative emotions are absolutely useless. They do not serve any useful purpose. They do not make us acquainted with new things or bring us nearer to new things. They do not give us energy. They only waste energy and create unpleasant illusions. They can even destroy physical health. Thirdly, after a certain amount of study and observation, we may come to the conclusion that we can get rid of negative emotions, that they are not obligatory. Here, the system helps because it shows that in fact there is no real centre for negative emotions, but that they belong to an artificial centre in us, which we create in childhood by imitating people with negative emotions by whom we are surrounded. People even teach children to express negative emotions. Then children learn still more by imitation. They imitate older children. Older children imitate grown-ups. And so at a very early age, they become professors of negative emotions. It is a great liberation when we begin to understand that there are no obligatory negative emotions. We are born without them, but for some unknown reason, we teach ourselves negative emotions. Question: to be free from negative emotions, must we be able to stop them arising? Answer: this is wrong because we cannot control emotions. I mentioned the different speed of different functions. The slowest is the intellectual function. Next come moving and instinctive functions, which have an approximately equal speed, which is enormously quicker than intellectual. The emotional function should be still quicker, but generally works at about the same speed as the instinctive function. So moving, instinctive, and emotional functions are very much quicker than thought, and it is impossible to catch emotions by thought. Just to explain here that Gurdjieff divided human beings into three what he called centres: moving, thinking, and emotional. This might sound like hippie nonsense, but it actually chimes with a system from, I can't remember the name, but a mainstream psychologist. So basically, he's dividing human beings into motor function, cognition or intellect, and emotion. And if you think about it, that's a fairly obvious system. Everything that we do as human beings falls into those three categories. So we basically call them moving, thinking, and instinctive. So just so you know that those are psychological terms, but he's just using different language. And Gurdjieff's notion was that by mixing up these, the work of these three centres caused a lot of human problems. For example, trying to deal with emotional issues by using the intellectual function. When we are in an emotional state, they succeed each other so quickly that we have no time to think. But we can get an idea of the difference in speed by comparing thinking functions with moving functions. If doing some quick movement, you try to observe yourself, you will see that you cannot. Thought cannot follow movement. Either you have to make the movement quite slow or you cannot observe. This is a definite fact. Question. By movements, do you mean physical movements? Answer. Yes, ordinary things like driving a car or writing. You cannot observe anything of that kind. You can remember, and later it creates the illusion of observing. In reality, you cannot observe quick movements. So you see, as we are now, real struggle with negative emotions is a question of the future. Not a very far future, but there are many things we need to know first and methods which we must study. There is no direct way. We must learn roundabout methods of how to attack them. First of all, we have to change many of our mental attitudes, which are more or less in our power. I mean intellectual attitudes or points of view. We have too many wrong points of view about negative emotions. We find them necessary or beautiful or noble. We glorify them and so on. We must get rid of all that. So we have to clean our mind in relation to negative emotions. When our mind is right concerning negative emotions, when we have ceased to glorify them, then little by little we shall find a way to struggle with them, each separately. One person finds it easier to struggle with one particular negative emotion, another finds it easier with another. You must begin with the easiest, and what is easiest for me may be the most difficult for you. So you must find the easiest for yourself, and later come to the more difficult. Question. Does that explain why I associate certain of my own negative emotions with people I remember back in childhood? Answer. Quite probably, because many negative emotions are learned by imitation. But some may be essentially in our nature, because our nature also has different inclinations one way or another. Emotions can be divided into groups, and one person may be more inclined to one group and another to another group. For instance, some people have an inclination to different forms of fear, others to different forms of anger, but they are different and do not come from imitation. Question. Are they the hardest to struggle with? Answer. Yes, but they are generally based on some kind of weakness, because at the basis of negative emotions there generally lies a kind of self-indulgence. One allows oneself. And if one does not allow oneself fears, one allows anger. If one does not allow anger, one allows self-pity. Negative emotions are always based on some kind of permission. But before we come to such complicated questions as struggle with negative emotions, it is very important to observe ourselves in small, everyday manifestations of the moving function, and also those which we can observe of the instinctive function, that is, our sensations of pleasant and unpleasant, warm and cold, sensations like that which are always passing through us. Question. What negative emotions are you likely to glorify? Answer. Some people are very proud of their irritability or irritation or something like that. They like to be thought very hard. There is practically no negative emotion which you cannot enjoy, and that is the most difficult thing to realise. Really, some people get all their pleasure from negative emotions. Okay, so quite a lot to take in there, but I hope you will see that if you've listened to the previous episodes, that this very much, in a practical, down-to-earth sense, ties in with the existential and psychological work that we've been looking at in the last few episodes. Especially, you'll notice that here we're agreeing with Sartre's view of negativity in that it's something that we give ourselves permission to do, that a negative frame of mind is something that we choose to put ourselves into, just as we can choose to get ourselves out of it. And as with the psychological stuff that we've looked at in previous episodes, it's very much the opinion of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky that the hardest thing to do and what we really all ought to be doing is watching ourselves and watching out for us giving ourselves permission to become negative. We need to watch out for that and we need to stop it before it starts. And I'm sure you all realise how difficult that is, but believe me, I've been trying this for 25 years and I do often catch myself going negative, and a lot of the time I can stop it. And that's down to the fact that I've been reading Gurdjieff and Ouspensky for the last 25 years. So it is very practical and very useful, the vast majority of their work and their writings. And that's just a tiny snatch that you've had. The Fourth Way is a pretty long book, and most of the books are quite long and quite dense. There's a hell of a lot in there that is really very useful in the way that I try to make these podcasts and the book. So that's negative emotions and negative thinking. We'll doubtless be doing more of that in the next few episodes. I mean, looking at it, not doing it. It's not a negative thinking in the meaning of life, is it? No, it isn't. So, so we're going to finish now with another reading from Ouspensky's The Fourth Way. And this moves on to what I mentioned earlier, Gurdjieff's idea about us being more or less asleep. And so we're going to finish with this, him talking about our low levels of consciousness and how bad that is for us and the mechanics of how it works. And then in the next episode, we're going to look at what he called the work, which was using physical and mental exercises to try and shock ourselves out of this state of apathetic consciousness and out of allowing ourselves to slide into negative thinking. So next week, we're going to look at a lot more practical stuff. The rest of this episode, from Ouspensky's point of view, I think this is a good summary of the other major part of Gurdjieff's work, which is looking at our sleeping level of consciousness. Our thought has acquired many bad habits, and one of them is thinking without purpose. Our thinking has become automatic. We are quite satisfied if we think of and develop possible side issues without having any idea why we are doing it. From the point of view of this system, such thinking is useless. All study, all thinking and investigation must have one aim, one purpose in view, and this aim must be attaining consciousness. It is useless to study oneself without this purpose. There are reasons to study oneself only if one has already realized that one does not have consciousness and one wishes to attain it. Otherwise, it becomes just futile. Attaining consciousness is connected with the gradual liberation from mechanicalness. For man as he is fully and completely under mechanical laws. The more a man attains consciousness, the more he leaves mechanicalness, which means he becomes more free from accidental mechanical laws. The first step in acquiring consciousness is the realization that we are not conscious, but this illusion cannot be changed alone, for there are many others. As I said earlier, the worst of them is the illusion that we can do. All our life is based on this illusion. We always think that we are doing when, in reality, we are not doing anything. Everything happens. Another illusion is that we are awake. When we realize that we are asleep, we will see that all history is made by people who are asleep. Sleeping people fight and make laws. Sleeping people obey or disobey them. The worst of our illusions are the wrong ideas among which we live and which govern our lives. If we could change our attitude towards these wrong ideas and understand what they are, this in itself would be a great change and would immediately change other things. The chief obstacle to the attainment of self-consciousness is that we think we have it. One will never get self-consciousness so long as one believes that one has it. There are many other things we think we have, and because of this, we cannot have them. There is individuality or oneness. We think we are one, indivisible. We think we have will, or that if we do not have it always, we can have it, and other things. There are many aspects to this, for if we do not have one thing, we cannot have another. We think that we have these things, and this happens because we do not know the meaning of the words we use. There is a definite obstacle, a definite reason why we cannot have consciousness as we are. This chief obstacle in the way of development is lying. I have already mentioned lying, but we must speak more about it, for we do not know what lying means because we have never studied this question seriously. Yet the psychology of lying is really the most important part of the study of the human being. If a man could be described as a zoological type, he would be described as a lying animal. I shall leave out all external lying and take only a man's lying to himself, about himself. This is the reason why we are in the state in which we are now, and why we cannot come to a better, a higher, a more powerful, more effective state of consciousness. According to the system we are now studying, we cannot know truth, because truth can be reached only in objective consciousness. So we cannot define what truth is. But if we take it that lying is the opposite of truth, we can define lying. The most serious lying is when we know perfectly well that we do not and cannot know the truth about things, and yet never act accordingly. We always think and act as though we know the truth. This is lying. When I know that I do not know something, and at the same time say that I know, or act as though I know it, it is lying. For instance, we know nothing about ourselves, and we really know that we know nothing, yet we never recognize or admit the fact. We never confess it even to ourselves. We act and think and speak as though we know who we are. This is the origin, the beginning of lying. When we understand this and follow this line, and when we try to connect this idea with everything we think, everything we say and do, we will begin to remove the obstacles which lie on the way to consciousness. But the psychology of lying is much more difficult than we think, because there are many different kinds of lying and many very subtle forms hard to discover in ourselves. In others, we see them comparatively easy, but not in ourselves. The first lie we tell ourselves is when we say, I. It is a lie because in saying I, we presume certain things. We presume a certain unity and a certain power. And if I say I today and say I tomorrow, it is supposed to be the same I, when in reality there is no connection between them. We are in this present state because of certain obstacles or certain facts in ourselves, and the most important fact that we do not understand is that we have no right to say I, for it will be a lie. When you begin to observe yourself, you will see that it is really so. There are eyes in you which do not know one another and never come into contact. For instance, begin to study your likes and dislikes, and you will see that you can like one thing one moment and like another thing another moment, and the two are so opposed to one another that you will realize at once that those eyes never meet. If you observe your decisions, you will see that one eye decides and another has to carry out the decision, and this one is either unwilling to do it or never heard about it. If you find one thing one does not lie to oneself about, you will be very exceptional. Being surrounded by these lies, born and educated in these lies, we cannot be any different from what we are. We are just the result, the product of this lying. So, in conclusion then, we can see that this work of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky is agreeing with a lot of what Sartre and other existentialists said. What Ouspensky was saying there about lying ties in exactly with Sartre's ideas on bad faith and also on the psychological theory of cognitive dissonance. See the last couple of episodes if you haven't already, or the book. So that's what I'm trying to get with these podcasts and with books, is an overarching synthesis of science, psychology, philosophy, and these sort of esoteric ideas all together, and extract all the practical down-to-earth stuff that is actually of use to us in our everyday lives. So that's the end of episode 15. And next week we'll get on to the practical stuff. And hopefully by then I will not be chain eating cough sweets. So stay positive and see you next time. Bye. Oh yes, and please go to marcusfreestone.com and check out my books and music. The newly published, or published a couple of weeks ago, the new extended version of the book, Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life, is now available on Amazon and iTunes and all that as an ebook for $1.99 American. And I've just ordered my proof copy of the paperback. So within a week or two, the paperback should also be available. So please buy it, because I could really do with the money.